evening. It is 6 p.m. in the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., and you are tuned to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. And for the next hour, we will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Well, all right. The 2018 midterm elections are officially over. Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith, a Mississippi Republican, won the special runoff election yesterday, defeating the Democrat candidate Mike Espy, who was trying to become the state's first black senator since Reconstruction. Hyde-Smith will serve out the final 2 years of Thad Cochran's term and make history as the first female elected to Congress from Mississippi. This sets the Republican majority in the Senate chamber to 53-47, Republicans to Democrats, once the new Congress is sworn in. It's a net pickup of 2 seats for the Republicans. Do the results in Mississippi provide any additional information about the American political landscape? If so, what? For insight into this, we turn to my first guest. He's an American scientist and the Associate Dean for Research and Professor of Biological Studies at the Joint School for Nanoscience and Nanoengineering, which is jointly administered by North Carolina Agricultural and Technical State University and UNC Greensboro. His focus is on the biology of race, and he has authored 2 books, The Emperor's New Clothes, Biological Theories of Race at the Millennium, and The Race Myth, Why We Pretend Race Exists in America. Dr. Joseph Graves, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Well, thanks for having me back on.
Thank you so much. We wanted to get a wrap-up on this issue now that the numbers are in, and we're moving now from the hypothetical or theoretical into the real. So, first of all, your overall thoughts now that the numbers are in and the race in Mississippi is over.
Well, I don't think that the Hyde-Smith's victory in Mississippi tells us anything new or different from the current state of race relations in the United States. I mean, Donald Trump ran on a campaign of xenophobia and pandering to racist fears that exist within the mainstream, or I won't say the mainstream, of many people of European descent in the United States. Hyde-Smith ran her campaign around the theme that she's supported Donald Trump on virtually every measure that he's put forward. She didn't really present any sort of new program of her own, from what I could tell from a distance. So the fact that there were a lot of people of European descent predominantly in Mississippi, and unfortunately, again, many of these people, working class or even people who are sub-working class, voted for this candidate. So we're seeing, again, the trend that we saw in the 2016 election still going forward here.
One of the issues or one of the dynamics that has developed as analysts are looking at the national numbers, this trend of urban and suburban going to Democrats and rural America going towards Republicans. And so when we look at the map of Mississippi and how things played out, we see DeSoto County, which I believe is close to Memphis. And with that, we saw Mike Espy carrying DeSoto County, basically following the trend of the urban suburban element going to a Democrat. And then we saw, for the most part, the rest of the state going towards Hyde-Smith. Your thoughts on this urban-suburban dynamic from a racial perspective?
Well, again, if you look demographically at from socially defined race categories, Memphis, the county closer to Memphis, undoubtedly had more African-Americans and other non-European Americans in both the urban areas and the suburban areas. In the rural aspects of Mississippi, sure, there were higher percentages of persons of European descent, although, you know, Mississippi being part of the historical Black Belt, there are also a lot of African-American voters in some of the rural counties. But the thing that, you know, Trump's strategy has play to, as I said earlier in my comment, is this notion that the Democratic Party years of Barack Obama basically neglected the white working class and rural persons in this country. And while that wasn't true in terms of the actual policies that were put in place during Obama's administration, that idea has legs, and it still has legs. Those folks feel that the country has let them down and has been shuttling their resources to other groups, and therefore they are ripe for this Trump-type propaganda, which Hyde Smith ran on.
Which is also playing itself out right before our eyes with the General Motors news that they're cutting all of these jobs. Donald Trump promised that the factories would be reopened and the factories would be, if they weren't, they'd be torn down and rebuilt. And now what we find is General Motors and Ford, the jobs aren't coming back. They were sold a pig and a poke.
Yeah, and it's hard for anybody to believe. In fact, CNN did an interview with a GM faculty worker earlier today who had worked at GM for 40 years and had voted for Donald Trump, and heard her comments about how Trump has done so much for manufacturing in the United States. And her response was that she was offended because, quite frankly, what has been keeping manufacturing in the United States has been a series of concessions by the labor unions to the automakers, which, you know, end up in their workers losing wages, losing benefits, behind the idea of keeping them here. So, you know, for Trump to make these claims, they completely fly in the face of actual lived experience of working class people. And they also fly in the face of what virtually every college student who's taken a class in econ, economics 101, can tell you about the way labor markets act in the world. So his idea that he could somehow force companies to keep jobs in the United States under the, you know, basic context of global capitalism is insane. And I got to believe that he's not stupid enough to actually believe it. And so when he says these things, it's more an example of his cynical character, the way that he will simply tell bald-faced lies to people so that he can get their support, because he knows better than that.
You have a book, The Race Myth, Why We Pretend Race Exists in America. And my next question, I know, could be an entire semester's class. But within the couple minutes that we have, I have always said that there is no such thing as race in America. That, in fact, if you go back and look at the literature before the Europeans came to North America, they spoke in the context of nations because they were white and there weren't people of color. And so France was concerned with Germany and Germany was concerned with Britain. And they dealt in a nationalist context, and that the whole concept of race did not even really come into the language until they came here to North America and had to figure out a way to justify and rationalize enslaving captured Africans.
You're absolutely correct. And I tell that story in the first book, The Emperor's New Clothes. That book is a history of the development of racial thinking in the Western world. And so for your listeners, if they're going to read these books, I strongly recommend that you read The Emperor's New Clothes, Biological Theories of Race at the Millennium first, because it provides that historical context for how biological race concepts and socially defined race concepts got mixed up in the American context. The Race Myth is a book that assumes you understand that already.
Okay.
What it examines is the ongoing problems that result from racial thinking in the United States.
And so let me stop you there, because here's the question I want to ask that I think will take us where you're about to go. There were photos circulated of Senator Hyde Smith wearing replicas of Confederate military garb during a 2014 visit to Beauvoir, the last home of Confederate President Jefferson Davis. This woman, Elizabeth Gallinghouse, is reported as having said, "So many things are taken out of context. The fact that she toured Jefferson Davis's house, you or I could have done the same thing. They said, put this cap on, hold this gun. It was fun time. She wasn't trying to send any messages, according to Mrs. or Ms. Gallinghouse. Black Mississippians heard a message based in a racist context. Elizabeth Gallinghouse, a white Mississippian, heard another message. Wearing a Confederate Army hat was fun time with no message trying to be sent. Talk about these different perspectives and why this code language, with some are now calling dog whistle, and some of it is not so dog whistle.
Yeah, so my response to that is only a person of European descent who has absolutely no understanding of American history could make those claims about Confederate paraphernalia.
And Ms. Gallinghouse is 84 years old.
Yeah, and no matter how old she is, I mean, there are things called libraries. There are things called books. There are firsthand accounts of what the Confederacy was, what it attempted to do, its rationale for existence. There are firsthand accounts of the misery of human beings who went through chattel slavery. There are firsthand accounts of what happened during Reconstruction and the Civil Rights Movement in Mississippi, and all of these things associated with the underlying idea of white supremacy, which the Confederacy embodied. So for someone to make that claim, it means that either you're living under a rock, which I just don't believe, or you are attempting to apologize for white supremacy. And so, therefore, it's okay for white folks to be able to do things which are harmful to persons of color. That's entirely okay. It's joke time. No one would make that claim if, for example, a German politician went to the birthplace of Adolf Hitler and was posing in Nazi paraphernalia. No one would say that. But in the United States, we continue to glorify an institution that was genocidal in its character. Slavery was an institution which built the wealth of the United States, transferred that wealth into the hands primarily of persons of European descent, and did so on the backs of black bodies, of people who died and died early, suffered, were tortured, were raped. That is the history of the United States. And the fact that these people are unwilling to live up to that history and attempt to cover it up with all sorts of euphemisms and misrepresentations, and in many cases, turning the Confederacy into a heroic institution, is at the root of this problem.
Let's shift the conversation to the broader national context. The Democrats are sending a very diverse group of representatives to Washington, women, two Muslim women, a gay Native American woman, for a very diverse group of representatives. Are you concerned that we, with this, particularly with these optics, that we can get caught up in the politics of phenotype and lose track of the politics of policy, that we will look at this almost the way that the Obama early years were, oh, we're now in post-racial America, more quantitative politics and less qualitative policy?
Well, that certainly could happen. And I have to tell you that I'm not a big fan of the Democratic Party. I generally, when I vote Democratic, I'm voting from the point of view of the least of two evils. But I do not think the Democratic Party is a progressive party. And so with folks of color and gay people and women being a part of the party, that in and of itself doesn't solve the problem that America has. What we need is a political program that can really address these problems. And so long as the Democratic Party is wedded to the way things run in this country, and here I mean the global economic system of capitalism, so long as the Democratic Party believes that capitalism is the way forward for the American people, they're never going to solve these problems. What we will see is a pendulum going back and forth in the limited political spectrum of Republican and Democrat. The Democrats are the folks that like to run capitalism with at least a humanitarian face to it, whereas the Republicans tend to be people who don't really care about the humanitarian aspects of the system. But the system itself can't solve our problems. And so it's sort of becoming more and more of a runaway train. This is why Trump can't bring manufacturing back to the United States, no matter how much he says he would like to. He simply can't do it. the market doesn't work that way. And so when a system does what it's designed to do, no one should be surprised about that. And what it's designed to do is to concentrate wealth into the hands of a very small portion of the population, and to, on the other hand, extract that wealth from the much larger portion of the population. So unless we in the United States can start thinking in new ways about what social justice actually looks like, what kind of nation we want to be, how do we want to be represented in the world as people who are there trying to help build a peace and understanding and you know, economic reciprocity and the best aspects of being a human being, or whether we are a nation that is simply interested in extracting the resources and labor power of the rest of the world for our own good. So that's the question that we as the American people need to answer. And we will not be able to answer that in the context of the Republican and the Democratic Party.
Especially when, if we look at the founding documents of the country, if we look at the Three-Fifths Compromise, if we look at the fugitive slave provision, if we look at how long the importation of slaves was allowed to exist once the Constitution was ratified, there are so many elements that are woven within the very fabric of this country. We can talk about the Trail of Tears and how Native Americans were disenfranchised in North Dakota. So many things. So just in the minute and a half we have left, you're doing it in the classroom. I'm doing it in the classroom. You're doing it with your research and writing. I'm doing it with my research and writing. But are we making a dent in changing the dialogue, changing the narrative, changing the perspective?
Well, that's one thing that history will determine. I mean, and even if I weren't making a dent, I would do it anyway because it is the right thing to do.
Absolutely right. My parents always told me, Wilmer, the one thing about right, it's always right. Dr. Joseph Graves, sir, thank you so much for your research, so much for your time. Hopefully I can now declare you as part of our family here at the Critical Hour, and we look forward to having you back on much more regularly.
Whenever you need me, feel free to call.
Thank you, sir. Greatly, greatly appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, folks, you are listening to the Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. House Democrats are choosing their leadership today. They've chosen their leadership today, and the final speaker's vote is weeks away. There are two schools of thought on the candidates and the outcome. For insight into this, we turn to my next guest. He's the host of The Gary Flowers Show on radio station Rejoice, WREJ AM 990. His show airs from 9 to 11 a.m. on weekdays in Richmond, Virginia. Gary Flowers, as always, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you so much, Dr. Leon. I'm always available when you call in this most perilous of times.
To get the analysis, you're one of those minds I got to turn to, and I truly appreciate you being available. So House Democrats met privately today to select new leaders for the incoming Congress, including caucus chair, House Majority Leader, and Whip. And Nancy Pelosi won. She is now going to be she's the Democratic nominee to be the Speaker of the House. Let me get your initial thoughts on, as you read the list of who's coming into place, what are your thoughts?
We've seen this movie before, and it didn't end well. That's an overview. I worked closely with Speaker Pelosi when I was CEO of the Black Leadership Forum. And while I concede her political background, daughter of a legislator, her long years of experience, her fundraising capability, I believe that the Democratic Party lost 1,000 seats during the Obama administration, partly because of an overly cautious approach to public policy and to politics. what I've learned in my 30 years is that politics is a contact sport. And if you're not ready to get dirty, and I mean that loosely, not that you're doing anything nefarious, but if you're not willing to bump and grind, if you will, using the sports vernacular, you're not going to have the desired outcome. Let me give you an example.
So just to put a pin there real quick. So when Michelle Obama says, when they go low, we go high. No, when they go low, that says, no, you kick them.
Yeah, you meet them where they are.
Eric Holder. Thank you, Ebony. Eric Holder.
Because here's the deal. I am an unabashed progressive, and I do not agree with Republicans on hardly anything, but I do respect their use of power. When they have power, they use it effectively and efficiently. Now, they cheat most of the time, but I do respect their attitude toward power. The Democrats, and Speaker Pelosi in particular, begin negotiations from the center of the table, which is in violation of Negotiation 101. It is as though the Democrats come to an alley fight with a dictionary and a thesaurus. And so with respect to the health care bill, the Affordable Care Act, I worked closely with Speaker Pelosi and President Obama and his administration. And on the progressive side, we argued that there should be a single-payer system. And I understand that that's probably was not going to garner the votes necessary. So our fallback position was a public option. That was the spirit going into the fall.
Which the president ran on.
Exactly.
He ran on the public option and then ran from the public option once he became president.
And lo and behold, we see Valerie Jarrett on Meet the Press, and she's announcing that the public option is not on the table. And we had an immediate meeting with the Black Leadership Forum and the president and Speaker Pelosi, and they're giving us a song and a dance about, you know, this is the only way it's going to pass. Let's unpack the NAFSAC, Dr. Leon. The healthcare bill is reflective of why I think the Democrats should move beyond Speaker Pelosi. Here's why. The Affordable Care Act, without the public option, was just a mandate for 33 million people to buy health insurance, whether they had a job or not. We asked Speaker Pelosi.
It was a windfall for Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Exactly. We asked Speaker Pelosi, then Speaker Pelosi, and President Obama to put forth the jobs bill first. All of that said, when you negotiate from the center of the table, you're going to end up on the other, on your adversary's side.
Mm-hmm.
And in this era, we need new leadership on the progressive side. We're already hearing cautious talk by the soon-to-be committee chairs. Elijah Cummings from Maryland, Bobby Scott from Virginia. And that is not good for American public policy. People, the workers in Detroit now are wondering if they're going to have jobs when General Motors says they're going to close 5 plants.
Mm-hmm.
Cautious approach. We've seen this movie before, and it didn't work well. There needs to be new leadership in the Democratic Party, or there needs to be a new political party to the left of the Democrats, because the Democrats are really Republican light.
So when you look at who many assume will be House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, she's 78 years old. Steny Hoyer is expected to be the House Majority Leader. He is 79. Majority Whip is Jim Clyburn. He's 78. To your point, how much of this, and I don't want to sound like I'm discriminating again from an age discrimination point, but there does seem to come a point, as Mufasa would say, in the cycle of life when you gotta step aside and you've got to provide the space and the coaching and the counseling. You've got to develop your bench. And they really don't seem to have developed a bench.
Well, and they're not looking to. Power is corruptive. And power yields itself only to other power. And in the case of the leadership you just named, they're not willingly going to step aside. It has to be taken. And right now, the progressives are mounting, you know, momentum for that. You would think that in order to move the party forward, that they would have groomed younger talent. Now, I'm not discriminating against their age. I disagree with their centrist policy perspective.
And some of that centrist policy perspective comes over time and comes with age.
Exactly. And here's what I have learned from my years in sports. Some teams play to win. Other teams play
not to lose.
And the Democratic Party
has been playing not to lose.
35 years under the Clinton machine, through which Speaker Pelosi came, has been playing not to lose. And that's not a winning formula, whether it's football or whether it's politics.
Now, you had candidates such as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. You had other younger folks that were coming in, and many of them saying, no Nancy Pelosi, no, no, no. And many of them now seem to be acquiescing to the pressure being placed upon them as they now look to be sworn in and come into.
You know what's interesting, Dr. Leon? The Democratic Party plays harder politics within.
Internally than externally.
Than externally. So they're playing hardball politics with.
Talk directly in your phone, please.
Yeah, the younger and the progressive wing of the party. By saying, we're not going to give you any committee assignments. We're not going to give you any perks for your district unless you shut up. And the acquiescence has taken place because of hardball politics within the Democratic caucus. Yet, that hardball politics is not seen as the Democrats take on Republicans for public policy formation.
Nancy Pelosi has been talking about pay-as-you-go, federal spending and pay-as-you-go. That sounds to me like austerity light.
It is. And that's why they are Republican-like in their policies. That is not what the American people need now. The American people, workers, have lost relative wages over the last 35 years. I mean, in that sense, the American people need more in their proverbial pots, if you will. And the Democratic Party is not putting forth such a policy agenda.
Are we looking at a party that in 2 years is basically going to be exactly where it was 2 years ago? And they will not have been progressive enough. They will not have been aggressive enough to be able to go out and explain to the American people, here's where the problems are. And here's what the real solutions are. The math is very simple to do here. And we're going to show you how to do this math.
The Democratic Party has never had a coherent policy agenda. You have 550 different perspectives. And therefore, they cannot articulate clearly to the American people what any agenda, let alone a progressive agenda, that takes all Americans forward as an economic, educational, healthcare, and workers' rights agenda. That is not clearly articulated. And so, therefore, I agree with you. In 2 years, the Democratic Party will be essentially where it is now. That's why I'm advocating our allies around the world have 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 parties for a coalition government. That is what's needed in the United States of America. As long as we have a duopoly of Republican Party and Democratic Party, it is stagnant because neither want to see a third, fourth, fifth, or sixth party emerge because they will then have competition.
That takes me to Professor Lonnie Guinier in proportional representation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's what's needed. So I don't spend a lot of time bemoaning where the Democrats are. It's tragic that they play such a soft negotiating game that all of us suffer. And that's why it's worth discussing on your show. But I don't have a lot of faith in their coherence. I don't have a lot of faith in their backbone.
How much of this do you think one of the big things, in fact, you mentioned this, one of the big things that Nancy Pelosi gets credited with is fundraising.
Yes.
So, but when we look at who she's raising the funds from, many of them are coming from the same coffers that are funding the Republican Party. So if you look at that as point one, and then ask yourself, well, a lot of the policies that they really need to champion get labeled as either being race-based or they get labeled as being socialist. And they don't seem to have been able to explain to the American people, first of all, if it's a race-based policy and you are benefiting people of color, everybody in this country will benefit.
Exactly.
And socialism is socialism. It depends on how you define it. Whether it's, you know, we don't need welfare, but you have corporate, what are these tax breaks, but corporate welfare. So some of this has to do with, to your point, being strong, being clear, being aggressive, and taking control of the narrative, saying, we will not allow you to define this reality the way that you want to define it.
As you know from our mutual mentor, Dr. Ronald Walters, may he rest in peace and power. We went into the White House early in the Obama administration, met with the president and then Speaker Pelosi. And I remember Dr. Walters and John Payton of the Legal Defense and Educational Fund, may he rest in peace and power. We said to the president and to the then speaker, you fix the wall where it's leaking. And so we called for essentially a public policy Marshall Plan for people who are suffering in the United States of America. If the Democrats were to take such a policy position, they would engender and endear themselves to working people. Right now, working people, for the most part, have to hold their nose to vote Democratic because there's no clear articulation of a plan through public policy that will help them.
And a lot of that contributes to your urban, suburban, rural dichotomy.
Exactly. Exactly. And so with Speaker Pelosi, what then Speaker and maybe soon to be Speaker Pelosi represents is a return to what I call political public policy passivity.
Hmm. Explain that quickly, please.
That says that instead of being perceived as being too aggressive, we're going to be kind and gentle. And through our cautiousness, as they call it, we will make sure that we don't overplay our hand. But you graduated from Hampton Institute. You know that if you're playing bid whist and you do not bid the hand that you have that's a strong hand, your partner doesn't want to play with you the next game.
There you go.
That's what the Democrats don't seem to get.
They don't understand. They don't understand. So we've got this new group of individuals coming in, and many of them were Bernie Sanders supporters, and some of them were backed by Bernie. Do you see that having any impact, or has Bernie Sanders basically become the sheepdog that's been herding the disparate Democrats back into the herd?
No, I think, for instance, Congresswoman Cortez, remember, she took out a long-term centrist Democrat
mm-hmm.
who was said to be a protege of then-Speaker Pelosi and set in line to be the next speaker behind her.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have great admiration and great confidence that Congresswoman Cortez and the other congressional representatives who are very progressive will not go lightly into the night.
Okay. Well, from your lips to God's ears, let's hope that it works out that way.
Well,
well, actually, we have to make sure that it does.
Yeah, we have to do more than hope. We have to hold what may well be Speaker Pelosi and her leadership team to the fire.
There you go.
To a standard that benefits the people they say the Democratic Party represents. In other words, if I am in charge, if I'm the coach of the team, and that's what she seems to be poised for, if I'm the coach of the team and we're not scoring, then the coach has to get fired. The Democratic Party did not score under the Obama administration. In fact, they lost. They got swamped 1,000-0.
I got to stop you there. Gary Flowers, as always, sir, thank you very much. I greatly appreciate it. Talk to you again. Look forward to having you back. Folks, you are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There is more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Opponents of the war in Yemen have picked up momentum that led to a critical Senate vote today on whether to end U.S. support for the Saudi-led coalition, the Yemen Amendment. For insight into this and why it matters, we turn to my next guest. She's the executive manager of STAND, the student-led movement to end mass atrocities, Mac Hamilton. Mac, good evening and welcome to The Critical Hour.
Good evening. Thanks so much for having me.
So before we get into the detail of today's briefing and the subsequent vote, first, a little history. In a procedural vote, the Senate voted 55-44 against a similar measure in March, with 10 Democrats voting against it, but 5 Republicans voted in favor of it at the time. What brought about the change in the Senate leading to today's briefing and subsequent vote?
Sure, absolutely. So I think a lot has actually changed in the public discourse when it comes to Yemen and especially the U.S. relationship with Saudi Arabia and the murder of Jamal Khashoggi, I think, was part of that change. I think the murder of a American-based journalist really set folks on fire, and that was in both parties. So I think that though many of us have been working on Yemen for several years, that's really the main thing that seems to have turned the tide.
There was a briefing today. Mike Pompeo and Defense Secretary Jim Mattis went to the Senate, and they briefed a small group of senators. Gina Haspel was not there at the direction of the White House, those who were opposed to this amendment. We're hoping that the pressure from the White House, as well as Pompeo and Mattis's briefings, would kind of smooth things over, but it didn't quite work out that way.
Yeah, that's correct. I think a lot of Republicans really wanted to hear from Gina Haspel and were pretty dismayed when she wasn't called to the private briefing. And I think that from what we heard, some of the briefing was made public and some was not. There were a lot of questions that remained unanswered, both about the Khashoggi murder and about exactly how U.S. military support has been used within the context of the Yemen war. So I think that that's something that the White House is now going to have to take pretty seriously. The vote margin was pretty wide on this vote. So I think that they'd be going back to their papers and thinking about what their next move should be.
So we've held the audience in suspense long enough. Please tell us the outcome of today's vote.
Yes. So first, I should say that this is also a procedural vote. So there is a larger vote to come, but it still really shows the tide and where it's going. But the vote won by a margin of 63-37. So that is a much huger margin than we have ever seen.
And were there any votes that surprised you, either folks who may have voted earlier to table it, such as Menendez?
So Menendez changed his vote. Yep.
Go ahead.
I think all of the Democrats voted in line, which was, I believe there were 10 Democrats who had voted against us last time. And we had heard early on that Menendez, Reed, Cortez Masto, and Coons had changed their votes. But it turns out that I think all of the Democrats voted with us this time. And then actually, even throughout the vote, several Republicans changed their votes. And I think Lindsey Graham is a really interesting one. Bob Corker, who I think we're going to see him throw some amendments on the bill, but it's a positive step that he voted for it. Those are, I think, some of the more interesting ones. Portman is another one, but then several others had really led on this, including Mike Lee, who's the lead Republican sponsor on the bill, and then Rand Paul, who's been working on arms sales issues for a long time.
So let's unpack a little bit. This vote is significant on a number of different levels. One having to do with it's a pushback to the White House in terms of its relationship with Mohammed bin Salman, MBS. It's also, I see it as the Congress reclaiming its power as it relates to the War Powers Act. It's also, I think, even a larger kind of pushback against the president overall. So am I right there? And are there other elements here? Elaborate on that, please.
Yes, absolutely. So I think you've hit on most of the main issues. We have really been looking at this vote both in the context of Yemen and then also in the context of just the larger space of war and peace. And this is the biggest congressional action on war making since the Iraq war vote in 2002. So to me, this really demonstrates that lawmakers are willing to do more than just kind of condemn actions and hold briefings. They're taking much, much stronger action. And then, of course, I think this really requires us to take another look at the U.S.-Saudi relationship. I think many of us in the NGO community for years have been saying that we should not just be giving a blank check to Saudi. Of course, we have a lot that we want to get out of the relationship, but they shouldn't just be allowed to do as they please with U.S. funding and U.S. support. So I think those are kind of the two main things that I would point out. It's really been amazing to see progressives working with libertarians, working with constitutional conservatives on this effort.
Senate Majority Leader McConnell and others have argued that the United States needs to be involved in Yemen as a counter to Iran. And I've heard this described in a number of venues as a proxy war. Is this really a proxy war? Is it that simple, or are there nuances and contexts here that can't just simplistically be dismissed as the United States has to stay in because we got to fight Iran?
Sure. I mean, it's absolutely an oversimplification. There were some excellent floor speeches, Todd Young for one earlier today, that really teased out kind of that fallacy of thinking that, you know, the Houthis who have taken charge of the government are simply Iranian proxies. I think that it's important to look at the history of the conflict in Yemen and look at what the real grievances are that the Houthis have, most of which are really significant and really real, regardless of their tactics, they've also committed crimes against humanity in Yemen, that's to be certain. They do have a lot of grievances, and they want to be heard, and they want to be at the negotiating table. And I think that that's something that we need to take seriously. And I think also that the more and more we support Saudi Arabia, the more it turns the Houthis against us, right? And if we want to be able to work with them as the legitimate government, I mean, the fact is that it's been 4 years and, you know, all of the world's superpowers are backing Saudi and the Houthis are still not out of power. They're not going anywhere anytime soon. And I think that's something that we need to take seriously, and we need to show them that we are or that we can be a positive player in the space. And I think that's only going to happen if we show them that Saudi doesn't get a blank check from us.
That statement that you just made is incredibly, incredibly important. And I think it gets too often overlooked that the United States historically backs the wrong player in the game. And whether it's we don't understand the cultural dynamics involved in the country, or whether it's that we just want to come in and steal resources, or whether it's a matter of McDonnell Douglas and Raytheon and Lockheed Martin wanting to be sure that they get their billions of dollars of defense spending. I mean, pick a reason, but we just seem to continue to back the wrong army.
Yep, that sounds about right. And we've sold, I think, $110 billion in arms to Saudi this year alone. And I think that that is slated to be increased to something like $350 billion in the next 10 years in what is one of the largest sales in U.S. history. So, I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head when you are talking about these U.S. arms manufacturers. And, you know, we've seen tons and tons of Saudi lobbyists on the Hill spending lots of money because they want these sales and they want to continue to put their influence on Yemen as part of the Arabian Peninsula.
You know, earlier today, I was watching some of the network news, and they had John Bolton was asked if he had listened to the tapes that had been provided by the Turkey security forces on the murder and the dismembering of Jamal Khashoggi. And he said that he did not and that he saw no reason to do so. And then I think this was during a White House press conference. And then he looked and he said, does anyone in this room speak Arabic? And then he said, well, I don't speak Arabic, so why would I listen to the tape? And I kept waiting for someone to say, have you ever heard of an interpreter?
Well, certainly. And the fact that he's, you know, our former ambassador to the UN, he, I mean, of course, is aware that he could use an interpreter. And I think it's really disappointing to hear that as the argument for why he wouldn't look at something that's so important and really quite national security aligned. I think he and the administration should be taking a very close look at this.
I raised that point because, from what I understand, Trump has said he hasn't listened to the tape. Pompeo has said he hasn't listened to the tape. So I'm wondering if when Pompeo and Mattis went into that briefing today, if a lot of the senators felt insulted, as though you're coming in here and you haven't even really done your homework. So I wonder if they had come in better prepared, and especially if Gina Haspel had come into the meeting, if maybe the vote would have still passed, but maybe it wouldn't have been 63-37.
Yeah, I think that's certainly possible. And I think that that's something that the White House is going to be forced to look at this point. I think that, you know, such a wide margin and so many Republicans who are really looking for answers to this and who have been waiting for weeks for more answers on this, they're ready for more information. They require more information, and they're not just going to let the administration get away with it this time.
So where does this go now? It's a procedural vote, which means from here, amendments can be added and then it goes to the floor. Explain to my audience, because the fight isn't over yet.
Yep, correct. So for our Civics 101, I've been talking to my students about this as well. So this vote was a motion to discharge. So that means that it was taken out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, which, you know, oftentimes things get held up in committee. So this was a vote to bring it back out for full Senate consideration. So at this point, amendments can be added, and we'll be watching those really closely because we want to make sure that this bill still has some strong teeth when it's finished. And then it will go to another vote to proceed to consider, I believe is what it's called. And so that's the final vote on the bill.
Oh, you know what we didn't really do? We if you could, please, we didn't explain exactly what, as the bill stands now, exactly what they voted on. And let me also say to my audience that we're talking to Mac Hamilton. Mac Hamilton is the executive manager at STAND, the student-led movement to end mass atrocities. And we're talking about the vote that took place today in the Senate on the Yemen amendment. If you could please quickly just explain what they actually voted to do.
Sure, absolutely. So the bill invokes the War Powers Resolution of 1973, which was passed in the wake of the Vietnam War. And it was passed in order for Congress to take back over from the executive the responsibility for war making, a really landmark piece of legislation. And so this particular piece of legislation, this new one, SJ Res 54 on Yemen, invokes the War Powers Resolution and says, hey, Congress hasn't voted on, hasn't declared war in Yemen. So why are we, you know, providing mid-air refueling, which was actually cut off recently? But why are we doing that? Why are we providing military intelligence to Saudi Arabia and the UAE for, you know, targeting often civilian infrastructure?
School buses full of kids.
Yeah, exactly. Using U.S. manufactured bombs, in fact. So that's really what the legislation seeks to rectify. So it says that within 30 days of the passage of this bill, we must withdraw that support unless Congress votes on a formal war declaration, which, I mean, I don't think anyone thinks that they would do following the very unpopular 2002 Iraq war vote.
So this came out of committee. It now goes to the floor of the Senate, which everybody believes it'll pass the Senate. Then from the Senate, it has to go to the House. Now, we're coming up to the end of this session, and many doubt that it'll pass the House. And if I'm wrong here, please correct me. Many fear that it will not pass the House in the current House makeup, that it will have to wait until after January when the new session convenes, but then it's got to go back to the Senate to be voted on again. Is that correct?
Yeah, so we expect it to be a very close vote if it does go to the House, which we hope it will. On November 15th, and this is getting in the weeds a little bit, but a similar War Powers Resolution from the House was killed in a kind of backdoor move, and the vote was 201 to 187, so still pretty close. 15 Republicans crossed party lines on that. 6 Democrats voted against it, and then 17 Democrats didn't vote at all. So if we were able to move those Dems who didn't vote, as well as the Dems who voted against, I think that we would be able to clear our way to victory. And I think the House members are watching what happens in the Senate. So I think that we still can pass it.
That was going to be my assessment as well, that now that we've passed the midterms, now that the public sentiment has shifted dramatically, now that MBS is being exposed to be the devil that he is, and with its passing in the Senate to the degree that it has, momentum definitely seems to be going towards passage.
I think that's definitely on our side. I think, you know, if we do have to vote on it again in the coming Congress, I think that there's energy to do that. Of course, it'll be a Democratic House, which will make it a bit easier. And hopefully some of the Republicans on the Senate side will kind of stay on this. I think that now that they're on the record voting in favor, I think it'll be hard for them to backtrack at this point. So, you know, the advocacy community is ready to move this forward in the next Congress if we're unable to pass it in the lame duck.
Mac Hamilton, executive manager at STAND, the student-led movement to end mass atrocities. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you for your focus on this incredibly, incredibly important issue. And I always appreciate you and look forward to you coming back to the Critical Hour.
Thanks so much. I look forward to it as well.
Thank you. And again, folks, 63-37. The Yemen Amendment passed out of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. It moves to the full Senate. Folks, that is a very good thing. You've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you all for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you all right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe, stay warm. Peace and blessings. I'm out.